tea. I would want to be pretty sure of what I was getting. I have not yet seen the color of your money. I'll have the money in a day or two. I will think about your proposition and talk to you again. Now I want to go to the Monarch boarding house. You had better walk over there with me. Are you scared of the dark? I never was scared of the dark. If I had a big horse pistol like yours, I would not be scared of any booger man. I am not scared of the booger man. I don't know the way over there. You're a lot of trouble. Wait until I finish this hand. You cannot tell what a Chinaman is thinking. That is how they beat you at cards. They were betting money on the play, and Rooster was not winning. I kept after him, but he would only say, "One more hand," and pretty soon I was asleep with my head on the table. Sometime later, he began to shake me. "Wake up," he was saying. "Wake up, baby sister." "What is it?" said I. He was drunk, and he was fooling around with Papa's pistol. He pointed out something on the floor over by the curtain that opened into the store. I looked, and it was a big, long barn rat. He sat there hunkered on the floor, his tail flat, and he was eating meal that was spilling out of a hole in the sack. I gave a start, but Rooster put his tobacco-smelling hand over my mouth and gripped my cheeks and held me down. He said, "Be right still." I looked around for Lee and figured he must have gone to bed. Rooster said, "I will try this the new way. Now watch." He leaned forward and spoke at the rat in a low voice, saying, "I have a writ here that says for you to stop eating Chen Li's cornmeal forthwith. It is a rat writ. It is a writ for a rat, and this is lawful service of said writ." Then he looked over at me and said, "Has he stopped?" I gave no reply. I have never wasted any time encouraging drunkards or show-offs. He said, "It don't look to me like he stopped." He was holding Papa's revolver down at his left side, and he fired twice without aiming. The noise filled up that little room and made the curtains jump. My ears rang. There was a good deal of smoke. Lee sat up in his bunk and said, "Outside is place for shooting." "I was serving some papers," said Rooster. The rat was a mess. I went over and picked him up by the tail and pitched him out the back door for Sterling, who should have smelled him out and dispatched him in the first place. I said to Rooster, "Don't be shooting that pistol again. I don't have any more loads for it." He said, "You would not know how to load it if you did have." "I know how to load it." He went to his bunk and pulled out a tin box that was underneath and brought it to the table. The box was full of oily rags and loose cartridges and odd bits of leather and string. He brought out some lead balls and little copper percussion caps and a tin of powder. He said, "All right, let me see you do it. There's powder, caps, and bullets."
"I don't want to right now. I am sleepy, and I want to go to my quarters at the Monarch boarding house."
"Well, I didn't think you could," said he.
He commenced to reload the two chambers. He dropped things and got them all askew and did not do a good job. When he had finished, he said,
"This piece is too big and clumsy for you. You are better off with something that uses cartridges."
He poked around in the bottom of the box and came up with a funny little pistol with several barrels.
"Now, this is what you need," he said. "It is a 22 pepper box that shoots 5 times, and sometimes all at once. It is called the Lady's Companion. There is a sporting lady called Big Faye in this city who was shot twice with it by our stepsister. Big Faye dresses out at about 290 pounds. The bullets could not make it through to any vitals. That was unusual. It will give you good service against ordinary people. It is like new. I will trade you even for this old piece."
I said, "No, that was Papa's gun. I am ready to go. Do you hear me?" I took my revolver from him and put it back in the sack. He poured some more whiskey in his cup.
"You can't serve papers on a rat, baby sister."
"I never said you could."
"These shite-poke lawyers think you can, but you can't. All you can do with a rat is kill him or let him be. They don't care nothing about papers. What is your thinking on it?"
"Are you going to drink all that?"
Judge Parker knows. He's an old carpetbagger, but he knows his rats. We had a good court here till the pettifogging lawyers moved in on it. You might think Pope Gowdy is a fine gentleman to look at his clothes, but he is the sorriest son of a bitch that God ever let breathe. I know him well. Now they have got the judge down on me and the marshal, too. A rat catcher is too hard on the rats. That is what they say. Let up on them rats. Give them rats a fair show. What kind of a show did they give Columbus Potter? Tell me that. A finer man never lived. I got up and walked out, thinking I would shame him into coming along and seeing that I got home all right, but he did not follow. He was still talking when I left. The town was quite dark at that end, and I walked fast and saw not a soul, although I heard music and voices, and saw lights up toward the river where the bar rooms were. When I reached Garrison Avenue, I stopped and got my bearings. I have always had a good head for directions. It did not take me long to reach the Monarch. The house was dark. I went around to the back door with the idea that it would be unlocked because of the toilet traffic. I was right. Since I had not yet paid for another day, it occurred to me that Mrs. Floyd might have installed a new guest in Grandma Turner's bed, perhaps some teamster or railroad detective. I was much relieved to find my side of the bed vacant. I got the extra blankets and arranged them as I had done the night before. I said my prayers, and it was some time before I got any sleep. I had a cough. I was sick the next day. I got up and went to breakfast, but I could not eat much, and my eyes and nose were running, so I went back to bed. I felt very low. Mrs. Floyd wrapped a rag around my neck that was soaked in turpentine and smeared with lard. She dosed me with something called Dr. Underwood's Bile Activator. You will pass blue water for a day or two, but do not be alarmed, as that is only the medicine working, she said. It will relax you wonderfully. Grandma Turner and I bless the day we discovered it. The label on the bottle said it did not contain mercury and was commended by physicians and clergymen. Along with the startling color effect, the potion also caused me to be giddy and lightheaded. I suspect now that it made use of some such ingredient as codeine or laudanum. I can remember when half the old ladies in the country were dope heads. Thank God for the Harrison Narcotics Law, also the Volstead Act. I know Governor Smith is wet, but that is because of his race and religion, and he is not personally accountable for that. I think his first loyalty is to his country, and not to the infallible Pope of Rome. I am not afraid of Al Smith for a minute. He is a good Democrat, and when he is elected, I believe he will do the right thing if he is not hamstrung by the Republican gang and bullied into an early grave, as was done to Woodrow Wilson, the greatest Presbyterian gentleman of the age. I stayed in bed for 2 days. Mrs. Floyd was kind and brought my meals to me. The room was so cold that she did not linger to ask many questions. She inquired twice daily at the post office for my letter. Grandma Turner got in the bed each afternoon for her rest, and I would read to her. She loved her medicine and would drink it from a water glass. I read her about the Wharton trial in the New Era and the elevator. I also read a little book someone had left on the table called Bess Calloway's Disappointment. It was about a girl in England who could not make up her mind whether to marry a rich man with a pack of dogs named Alec or a preacher. She was a pretty girl in easy circumstances who did not have to cook or work at anything, and she could have either one she wanted. She made trouble for herself because she would never say what she meant, but only blush and talk around it. She kept everybody in a stir wondering what she was driving at. That was what held your interest. Grandma Turner and I both enjoyed it. I had to read the humorous parts twice. Bess married one of the two beaux, and he turned out to be mean and thoughtless. I forget which one it was. On the evening of the second day, I felt a little better, and I got up and went to supper. The drummer was gone with his midget calculators, and there were 4 or 5 other vacancies at the table as well. Toward the end of the meal, a stranger came in wearing 2 revolvers, and made known that he was seeking room and board. He was a nice-looking man, around 30 years of age, with a cowlick at the crown of his head. He needed a bath and a shave, but you could tell that was not his usual condition. He looked to be a man of good family. He had pale blue eyes and auburn hair. He was wearing a long corduroy coat. His manner was stuck up, and he had a smug grin that made you nervous when he turned it on you. He forgot to take off his spurs before sitting down at the table, and Mrs. Floyd chided him, saying she did not want her chair legs scratched up any more than they were, which was considerable. He apologized and complied with her wish. The spurs were the Mexican kind, with big rowels. He put them up on the table by his plate. Then he remembered his revolvers, and he unbuckled the gun belt and hung it on the back of his chair. This was a fancy rig. The belt was thick and wide and bedecked with cartridges, and the handles on his pistols were white. It was like something you might see today in a Wild West show. His grin and his confident manner cowed everybody at the table but me, and they stopped talking and made a to-do about passing him things like he was somebody. I must own, too, that he made me worry a little about my straggly hair and red nose. While he was helping himself to the food, he grinned at me across the table and said, "Heidi." I nodded and said nothing. "What is your name?" said he.
"Pudding and Tame," said I.
He said, "I will take a guess and say it is Mattie Ross."
"How do you know that?"
"My name is LaBeef," he said. He called it LaBeef, but spelled it something like LaBeouf. "I saw your mother just 2 days ago. She's worried about you."
"What was your business with her, Mr. LaBeef?"
"I'll disclose that after I eat. I would like to have a confidential conversation with you."
"Is she all right? Is anything wrong?"
"No, she's fine. There's nothing wrong. I'm looking for someone. We'll talk about it after supper. I'm very hungry."
Mrs. Floyd said, "If it is something touching on her father's death, we know all about that. He was murdered in front of this very house. There is still blood on my porch where they carried his body."
The man LaBeef said, "It is about something else."
Mrs. Floyd described the shooting again and tried to draw him out on his business, but he only smiled and went on eating and would not be drawn. After supper, we went to the parlor, to a corner away from the other boarders, and LaBeef set up 2 chairs there, facing the wall. When we were seated in this curious arrangement, he took a small photograph from his corduroy coat and showed it to me. The picture was wrinkled and dim. I studied it. The face of the man was younger, and there was no black mark, but there was no question but it was the likeness of Tom Chaney. I told LaBeef as much. He said, "Your mother has also identified him. Now, I'll give you some news. His real name is Theron Chelmsford. He shot and killed a state senator named Bibbs down in Waco, Texas, and I've been on his trail the best part of 4 months. He dallied in Monroe, Louisiana, and Pine Bluff, Arkansas, before turning up at your father's place." I said, "Why did you not catch him in Monroe, Louisiana, or Pine Bluff, Arkansas?"
"He's a crafty one."
"I thought him slow-witted myself."
"That was his act."
"It was a good one. Are you some kind of law?"
LaBeef showed me a letter that identified him as a sergeant of Texas Rangers, working out of a place called East Letta near El Paso. He said, "I'm on detached service just now. I'm working for the family of Senator Bibbs in Waco."
"How came Chaney to shoot a senator?"
"It was about a dog. Chelmsford shot the senator's bird dog. Bibbs threatened to whip him over it, and Chelmsford shot the old gentleman while he was sitting in a porch swing."
"Why did he shoot the dog?"
"I don't know that. Just meanness. Chelmsford is a hard case. He claims the dog barked at him. I don't know if he did or not."
"I'm looking for him, too," said I. "This man you call Chelmsford."
"Yes, that is my understanding. I had a conversation with the sheriff today. He informed me that you were staying here and looking for a special detective to go after Chelmsford in the Indian Territory."
"I've found a man for the job."
"Who is the man?"
His name is Cogburn. He is a deputy marshal for the federal court. He is the toughest one they have, and he is familiar with a band of robbers led by Lucky Ned Pepper. They believe Cheney has tied up with that crowd.
Yes, that's the thing to do, said LaBeef. You need a federal man. I'm thinking along those lines myself. I need someone who knows the ground and can make an arrest out there that'll stand up. You cannot tell what the courts will do these days. I might get Chelmsford all the way down to McLennan County, Texas, only to have some corrupt judge say he was kidnapped and turn him loose. Wouldn't that be something?
It would be a letdown.
Maybe I'll throw in with you and your marshal.
You will have to talk to Rooster Cogburn about that.
It will be to our mutual advantage. He knows the land, and I know Chelmsford. It is at least a two-man job to take him alive.
Well, it is nothing to me one way or the other, except that when we do get Cheney, he is not going to Texas. He is coming back to Fort Smith and hang.
Ho, ho, said LaBeef. It is not important where he hangs, is it?
It is to me. Is it to you?
It means a good deal of money to me. Would not a hanging in Texas serve as well as a hanging in Arkansas?
No. You said yourself they might turn him loose down there. This judge will do his duty.
If they don't hang him, we will shoot him. I can give you my word as a ranger on that.
I want Cheney to pay for killing my father and not some Texas bird dog.
It will not be for the dog. It will be for the senator and your father, too. He will be just as dead that way, you see, and pay for all his crimes at once.
No, I do not see. That is not the way I look at it.
I will have a conversation with the marshal.
It's no use talking to him. He is working for me. He must do as I say.
I believe I will have a conversation with him all the same.
I realized I had made a mistake by opening up to this stranger. I would have been more on my guard had he been ugly instead of nice-looking. Also, my mind was soft and not right from being doped by the bile activator. I said,
"You will not have a conversation with him for a few days at any rate."
How's that?
He has gone to Little Rock.
On what business?
Marshal business.
Then I'll have a conversation with him when he returns.
You will be wiser to get yourself another marshal. They have a plenty of them. I have already made an arrangement with Rooster Cogburn.
I'll look into it, said he. I think your mother would not approve of your getting mixed up in this kind of enterprise. She thinks you're seeing about a horse. Criminal investigation is sordid and dangerous, and is best left in the hands of men who know the work.
I suppose that is you. Well, if in 4 months I could not find Tom Cheney with a mark on his face like banished Cain, I would not undertake to advise others how to do it.
A saucy manner does not go down with me.
I will not be bullied.
He stood up and said,
"Earlier tonight I gave some thought to stealing a kiss from you, though you are very young and sick and unattractive to boot, but now I'm of a mind to give you 5 or 6 good licks with my belt."
"One would be as unpleasant as the other," I replied. "Put a hand on me and you will answer for it. You are from Texas and ignorant of our ways, but the good people of Arkansas do not go easy on men who abuse women and children."
"The youth of Texas are brought up to be polite and to show respect for their elders."
"I notice people of that state also gouge their horses with great brutal spurs."
"You'll push that saucy line too far."
"I have no regard for you."
He was angered, and thus he left me, clanking away in all his Texas trappings. I rose early the next morning, somewhat improved, though still wobbly on my feet. I dressed quickly and made haste to the post office without waiting for breakfast. The mail had come in, but it was still being sorted, and the delivery window was not yet open. I gave a shout through the slot where you post letters and brought a clerk to the window. I identified myself and told him I was expecting a letter of an important legal nature. He knew of it through Mrs. Floyd's inquiries, and he was good enough to interrupt his regular duties to search it out. He found it in a matter of minutes. I tore it open with impatient fingers. There it was, the notarized release, money in my pocket, and a letter from